the devil awakens.
Maximus wrests his life from the underworld.
Hey boy, what in the world are you doing here?
He was elated with his escape.
I wanted out.
I set out now in a box upon the sea.
Writer Center, so I'm really happy to be here with Henry and with all of you and with John Engstrom, my partner in crime and art for many decades. I do have a big project going on about dreaming, and you know, as a result of being interested in dreams, I had to get interested in visions and prophecy and so on. And I've been diddling around with that project for a long time. Interestingly, this whole ghastly decade that we've just experienced, and in fact starting a little before it, I've always really been interested in dreams and also in ESP. I don't have ESP, and actually nobody has ESP, I hate to tell you. But one of the things I discovered, not only in other people, as I was reading people's dreams from, you know, long, long ago, up through now, including mine, was that we may not have ESP, but our dreams definitely have ESP. One of the sort of central thing that was bad about this decade that we all had to suffer together, you know, was this sort of open season on violence that started with shock and awe about 10 years ago, and is certainly not over. Had its most recent little flare-up at the Boston Marathon, turning all of my students into basket cases of various kinds, although, of course, they would have been anyway, but that's a different kind. And I noticed, I was looking for this poem that I wrote like a month before 9/11, which clearly predicted it, and I don't know, it's lost from my computer. And then one that I wrote about a week after it, which again was totally traumatized but totally predictive of what was really going to happen, that was really bad, which was going to be torture. And I couldn't find them, and then I found in Trouble a couple of poems that were much earlier than that, you know, a couple of years earlier than that, but still seemed to have that weird quality of something coming. And I thought, okay, I'm going to give a reading, because I don't think nearly enough, you know, we didn't make much of the 10-year anniversary of Shock and Awe for some bizarre reason. But it really does feel like saying a decade has passed is a time to look back at it. So this reading kind of looks back and comes to a different place at the end. But I want to start with these couple of poems that were, you know, that came out, which means obviously they were written earlier, came out about 3 months before Shock and Awe. And one of them is based on a dream that a friend of mine had, and it's called A Vision. The city was falling, and the night around it was mean. The stars were falling, and the night was nervous and mean. The living people looked down at their feet or across at each other with knives in their nervous eyes. They did their usual crimes, and they drove their cars like they didn't care if a lot of people died. The man in the room at night was hard at work on something electrically powered. He needed a few more feet of extension cord. Stars falling and all, he didn't know where to at such an hour to go. And the night outside at the end of an era was scared. The stars were falling, and the night they fell in was mean. Two strangers across town plan to sell everything on Saturday morning and move to the ends of the earth. And they'd hung up a sign, Ambrose and Virginia. The man called up on the phone and drove to their house in the dead of night to the city's other side, across the dark, his eyes wide open and all his windows closed. Ambrose and Virginia had wire. The man wire twists like those you use to close bags at the top, and they wanted those. So the deal was done, and a smile was smiled all around, for these were the three just ones. And to prove it was so, the man, as he left, saw a tiny stick on the ground, at the end of which a tiny toucan and a cat were sitting in friendship, as quiet as they were small. A vision like that is not a promise of peace. It might have been the last one in the world we know. But as needs were met and the night survived by three, a cat and a toucan sat on the end of a stick. Everything is going to be all right. And we'll get back around to that at the very end. I'll read you the other one just because prophecy is so interesting. It's called The Dreadful Has Already Happened. Last week, roped together, three men fell 2,000 feet on Mount Rainier from ice to ice in the summer air. It was roughly the anniversary of Nagasaki, the one we forget, the aftermath, the also dropped. And many have died on that day, since that day, and many died hard, but such a long fall and for nothing. As if the world and its brilliant physics had no more heart than a bomb which implodes on its emptiness. The men who fell had time to see the antlers of the deer wheel by and the earth rise up from another place. Many more will fall. Many bombs will fall, and cities will fall, and terror fall on us and with us, and the sky come down. It will be the worse for us because we have fallen already. We have already been dropped. Freud, the title, I should have told you, is a quotation from Freud. It was something he used to tell his students who were going to become therapists, I think. The dreadful has already happened. It was a way of letting the young therapists help people who were in high anxiety, particularly with what he called war neurosis, that the thing they feared the most had already happened, and the reason they were getting upset. He may be wrong. I think he's wrong. Was because the thing that was happening now, or the thing that might happen in a minute, reminded them of that. So I was, for shock and awe, I was in England. And so the next day I wrote a poem because, as many of you will remember, I think, or some of you anyway, Sam, what's his name, at Copper Canyon Press, Sam Hamill, instantly created something called poets.org, and he invited everyone, all the poets and all the people who might be poets and all the kids and everyone to post poems starting in 24 hours from the horrible bombing of Baghdad. And I was, I heard about it really fast because my friend Olga Brumuth is a close friend of Sam Hamill's, so I wrote one of the first ones. And for Auld Lang Syne, Here it is. It's a letter to Mr. Bush. I showed it to Peter Dale Scott, and he didn't like it because he thought I was being totally sarcastic. So I should say, I'm not. I'm not. I can understand why he thought that. But I was actually thinking about how horrible it must be for Mr. Bush to realize he had ruined everything and that all these people were going to die. And he's a very immature guy, and he didn't have enough whatever to be doing the kind of thing he was doing. And I imagined him in this way. Dear Mr. Bush, you must be in hell. It's cold where you are. Much too cold to feel. Hell, too cold even to write this letter. I hope someone gets to you with plastic sheeting for a tent. Are your daughters with you? For their sake, I hope they're out drinking. Is your wife alive? Do you know? Can you sleep? What will you do with your memories there? The list of presidents, the multiplication tables, your graduation from kindergarten. Did they have one at your school? With tiny kids dancing the light fantastic and bombs bursting in air and all the s'mores and cups of Kool-Aid flying every which way in bits all of a sudden because some big man, for reasons of state, decided to wreck the building next door? And do you remember? I do. The little nest of triangles pointing the way to the fallout shelter? Did you ever think as a kid about a world in which all the animals were permanently dead? And your parents? And your best friend down the street? Does that worry you now in hell? Does it come back to you? I hope there is someone there you know who will hold hands and kiss you. I hope there is someone there warm, even if a stranger, someone whose heart still beats, who can hold you close in the hard rain. A friend of mine is a bluegrass fiddle player, and George Bush came to his concert last summer, and then, which bugged my friend, but when it was over, George Bush is like an aficionado of bluegrass fiddle playing. So he came up on the stage, and he turns out he's like a really charming guy, and he knows a lot of tunes. Oh, this one, and then we'll leave that horrible memory for a while, is called Poetic License Expires, A Bad Dream. I tried to tell you that I loved you, but it was impossible in the language I was given, and we were so far apart. I said, you, but they said, no, only he or it. I said, I, but they crossed it out because they recognized that name. They gave me 17 words. I had to use them all or none. I was longing for your kiss, but I had to write, yes, Socrates, obey, anthrax, fire, evil, enemy, us, infidel, they, barbarous regime, our flag, our people, good, clean, obey, anthrax, yes, yes, fire, yes, us. Yes, but anthrax, anthrax, evil, clean, enemy, they, obey, obey, our flag, our people, infidel, yes, yes, Socrates, your kiss. I had to write in 17 words to use the language I was given, far, impossible, they crossed it out. You know, I was in England, and so one of the things that was weird about that was that they were reading everybody's email who was writing to people outside the country, especially across the ocean. So, bizarrely, I knew that every single email I got was putting somebody on some kind of weird list, not to mention that I was not at home in America. So I was probably on the weird list too. So I sent that out to a lot of people by email. All right. I'm not very good at the passing of time.
Good.
I think I'll... A couple here I will. Yep. So time went on, didn't it? And we got depressed, didn't we? And while I was depressed, I won't linger there long, but I mean, depressed is different from being shocked and miserable and so on and so forth. It's kind of the kind of state of mind you get in when you think about things like, oh, this dust that I just wiped off of my keyboard, it's full of people's dead skin cells who died. That was the state of mind I was in. I was working in Paris, so it's got some places in it that are in part of Paris, and in particular, I was at a cafe on an island in the middle of the Seine, which is about as wide as this writer center, and on the other side of the Seine from where I was the Conciergerie, which is the old 17th century prison. I describe it in the poem, so I don't have to here, where Marie Antoinette and her husband Louis XVI and their little kids were in prison for a long time before they were dragged out on those timbrels, not the kids, but the grown-ups, and taken to the execution center, which is now, of course, a big mall, and guillotined. I think that's all you need to know. Oh, yeah, and the bridge. It's called the Port au Change. It's where the moneylenders and the money exchangers used to do their work back in the early modern period. Back when the Conciergerie was built. It's called Sandcastle. Across the narrow street and half a river from this sad cafe looms the sandcastle, La Conciergerie, topped with gray cones compacted in a witch's hat by serious children on the beach, its tiny windows filled with molten sand. Inside, the dust of centuries is swept around by janitors who live due east of here and always have. I was a child myself when I discovered what's in dust, the last of Krakatoa, radioactive particles from Little Boy, mites from the eyebrow of the queen who slept there her last night before the guillotine, skin flakes pulverized by time and the astounding weight of air that weighs upon us all, her husband's hair from his last shave before the guillotine, the dandruff of the guards who took them out to ride the timbrel in the morning light in filthy clothes, mildewed by creatures who can thrive in dungeons where they leave a stain impossible to clean. You can still buy Marie's perfume in the gift shop at Versailles. The bathroom mirror shows my pores are clogged with grime, compacted of the skin and mites, hair of all the dead, not just the queen and king, but the dead forests blown from the tailpipes of the velos, motorcycles, gliding past between the cafe windows and the Conciergerie and Robespierre and girls who leapt when people couldn't swim from the Pont au Change into the filthy Seine, and pigeons, cats, Madame de Sévigné, and ordinary men. Where are the snows of yesteryear? The poet asked. They're here, in the ice cubes of my drink, and there, in the filthy Seine that flows beneath the Pont au Change. I wrote that poem at a table opposite the great writer P.B. O'Sullivan, who sits in the back row.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to skip a couple things because you know what was interesting to me? How do you pull out of, oh my God, there's like 40 poems of misery from that period? How get out of that? I started to think about animals. I started to like think about them and pretend to be them and stuff like that. So I'm going to read you a few of those. This one is called We Are Devo. It is interesting to note that the oldest extant fish, the coelacanth, which looks like it patched its outfit together from a garbage can and then died in it, has taken its extra eons of evolution to develop a permanent look of decrepitude. The young coelacanths of the Indian Ocean don't chase diatoms and krill or even eat their young. They don't hunger for love. They seem to mate by accident when they do, as if one was sorting through a pile of saved rags and the other was in it. Who here has seen a coelacanth or a picture of one? Oh my God. Well, now you know exactly what they look like. And they are, how old are they in the evolutionary picture? Do we know? What?
In the millions.
The Devonian. A
couple hundred million, I think.
A couple hundred million? The Devonian, yeah. Really old. And there they are in the waters, the warm waters off of Indonesia, looking that way. This one's called Think Again. Human beings think things with fur are plenty warm, but let me say, as a vole scuttering just under the frost-hard leaves in the underbrush of this scratchy wood trying to find a berry, that I am mostly skin and bones and using calories every minute of the day, so unlikely to get fatter as February runs me down. Understand, winter is hard on all of us. What's it like to scramble among pebbles and frozen leaf rot all day with your heart in a twist from owls and your paws numb as the paws of a dead bull, and then if nobody gets you, you get a frozen red berry that tastes like it might just kill you anyway? Somebody once told me, possibly you, that all animals out there are starving. Apparently, our minds work best at that particular relationship to calories. All right. I am going to read you. Is it okay to do? I read you three more poems?
Sure.
So one of them, the longest one, the others are short, is really about global warming, but I called it Dry Spell, and everybody here is some kind of an artist or other, so you all know what I mean. But it was like the hottest July on record in Europe, and there we were, hot. And I had just been rendered totally speechless by the level of violence in the world. I could not imagine what I had to say at all. And years went by which I didn't. Just trying to see if there's anything you need to know here. Except that in the very last section, number 5, I am thinking about people I'm thinking about again, and I think about a lot, which is all the people who work to pick the vegetables and the fruits that we eat. It's called Dry Spell. The tip of my elbow is no longer my own, though it is glued to my arm with sand. The sky cannot suck a single cloud from the yard's dust, from the baked roses. Among the cornrows, the crows starve. If my mind were a plowed field, it would crack open, but the rain of the world's calamity could not soak in. My mouth clatters like a wheelbarrow over the cobblestones of my teeth. Heaped full of rubble from the burnt silos at the edge of my mind. 2. Water is heavy, but this paper dry body is heavier still. Or maybe the soul with its stone feet and its stone suitcase weighs it down. 3. What grows in the furrows of a desiccated brain? Is there a desert lichen or a silicon-based bacterium fond of the sand that fills the old canals? It's alive. Something consumes something. 4. If the tempest broke the egg white sky, if the lion drooled, if the vein gushed, if the fountain cooled the dusty child, if the president cried, if the ocean rose, if the dikes split, if the dew came back to the brittle grass and the hedgerows and my burning eyes. 5. It is wrong to want water in July in the temperate zone. The better part of delight, our duty, if we were made, is wanting cantaloupe and endless light. Bent double in the fiery field, heaving melons into a cart in light too bright to see, the duty we're made to do. From dawn to dark, we can't drink or be. If there were a god to irrigate the world his impulse made, and a god to do the picking and carry melons to me, or a god to do the wanting in the shade of not to be. 'm skipping some things, but I can't. I really want to end with the song of the beaver, so they'll just have to die. Here is the poem, very short sonnet that I wrote, thinking when I was in Bonn this last summer visiting a friend, and she pointed out a beautiful, beautiful bridge that wasn't there anymore. There was a lot of fighting in Bonn. A lot of it was destroyed, as most cities in Germany were. And I just thought about what that was like. Because, you know, her parents had lived there, and they were there. The bridge. And I did have a dream. Whenever I say that in a poem, it's always true. The bell tolled inside and outside the dream, which was therefore true and told of the past. The story of one stretch of the fast river as it passed in those days, the skeletons of the birch trees and their thin, hungry arms, and our grandmothers dipping the laundry in the cold that ran past, and the armed men moving among the pylons, the beautiful bridge standing and then not standing, its dark stones shooting skyward and outward. Grandmothers going round in a rush among rushes, gathering in the wet linens before the blood in the water reached them and ruined the day's labor. The instinct that lives. And a few days after the bombings at the marathon, I thought about this late spring, so late, it's so cold, and something I'd noticed about a snowdrop coming up in the garden across the street from me. Something really weird. It's called The Strange Thing About a Snowdrop. It pushes its way up through lumps of dirt, pebbles, and dead snow as if it weren't pushing, as if they weren't there. It just unfolds, oblivious, without aggression or urgency. It has no designs. It is not intelligent. It can't get dirty. It just unfolds like a machine, except in absolute silence and greaselessly. If it were a monster, it would scare us to death. And I'm going to end with one of my many animal poems. Song of the Beaver. God knows where this came from. It was a bad February evening. I was grading very late. I was not happy. And yet the Song of the Beaver came to me. I'm just a little beaver prancing in the snow. Jawed me down a pine tree, feeling all aglow. Gonna drag it to the lake, bolster up my dam. I'm acting like a beaver, cause a beaver's what I am. But in my dream last night, I flew among the stars, flirting with the beaver ghosts on my way to Mars. Acting like an angel on furry angel wings. A beaver's gotta think about a lot of other things. My teeth are good for chawing, my tail for slapping, no, and my soul for flying starward high above the snow.
Thank you, Mary. John Engstrom.
Well,
thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
You bet.
Mary is a hard act to follow. I will do my best.
Thank you.
What's with the...
Oh, it's a full moon. I don't know. Is that my screensaver?
That's not my
sorry.
Stuff.
Sorry. Yeah. You know what? Yeah, there it is. Yeah, there I'm sorry. I'll now that I'm done with the talking, I can deal with the tech part.
Okay. Good.
I will try to get... Let's see. Sorry, great. I'm like great. Bad tech.
Okay. Well, if you get bored with what I'm reading, you always will have the images to look at. Or vice versa. Could you go back to that one that was just...
You bet.
Yeah, the one of me on the right there, that was taken before I became interested in scapegoating. I became interested in scapegoating around puberty when it occurred to me that that I was being scapegoated. And the people who were scapegoating me were members of my own family. So that's how I got first interested in the Salem witch trials, because of the thing that happened of members of families accusing each other of being witches. This was very interesting to me. So this is one of the subjects that I've been interested in for so long that I almost can't remember why I first got interested in it, but that was why, scapegoating. And... Why Witches Were Weird. Okay, here we go. Why Witches Were Weird is not meant to denigrate modern witches, who are fine and dandy, nor does it reference the weird sisters of Shakespeare's Macbeth. It refers to those anomalous people with physical or mental difficulties or some other condition that marked them as odd, who faced the iron hand of the law during the Salem witchcraft prosecutions. Though I've never been accused of, hanged, or pressed to death for witchcraft, like the people in 1692, from personal experience, I know what it feels like to be labeled, pigeonholed, stereotyped, categorized, marginalized, maligned, subjected to other forms of name-calling by society, and even by friends, because of realities that they were unwilling or unable to accept or acknowledge. To name people is to objectify and distance and draw lines around them. Whenever we put a cognitive label on somebody, we are all Salem Puritans thirsting for a blood kill. The first of these individuals I became interested in many years ago, when the Salem witchcraft stuff seemed incredibly compelling, and when the AIDS epidemic first arrived in Boston, with a sick, persecuted neighbor across the street comparing his plight with that of the Salem victims, was old George Jacobs. His disability was lameness, and like many of those accused, he had a strong personality that both got him in trouble and saw him through trouble. It's at his memorial service that the narrative begins. It's 8:30 in the morning of the 2nd of August, 1992, in the town of Danvers, Massachusetts. Founded in the 1750s from what had been Salem Village, Danvers is a bedroom community to Boston. The occasion is a 300 years belated memorial service and burial of, we think, a local farmer named George Jacobs Sr. Jacobs lived in Salem for 33 years, prospered, collected guns, scared his neighbors, and said, "Well, burn me or hang me, I will stand in the truth of Christ. I know nothing of it," at his witchcraft hearing. On 19 August 1692, he was hanged at Gallows Hill alongside John Proctor, another Salem farmer, who became the fictionalized protagonist of Arthur Miller's witch hunt play, The Crucible. After the deed was done, the five victims were stripped and jammed into a crevice between rocks. According to local history, Jacob's relatives rescued their father from the scene and reburied him in a secret spot. For generations, the Jacobs family lived in the sturdy saltbox-type farmhouse that bore his name and knew the whereabouts of their progenitor. The house didn't last through the first half of the 20th century, but it was captured in numerous photographs and old postcards in local antique stores. The Jacobs Memorial was part of Danvers Witch Trial Tercentenary Commemoration and unfolded in a full-scale replica of the Salem Village Meeting House in the 1600s with the historic Rebecca Nurse Homestead across the road. The primitive structure had been built for a TV miniseries, Three Sovereigns for Sarah, that caused a local stir, aired on PBS in 1985, and turned out to be not all that great. A visit to that production, which starred Vanessa Redgrave, was my last sojourn in the building. Then I was witness to a ceremony, the making of a film. This time, I was part of the ceremony, having been designated by Richard Trask, the town historian, to read a psalm that would be appropriate to a Puritan service. The one I picked was the 23rd, in which "Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies." In this case, the table was a real one, on which a modern replica of a 17th century coffin, a small custom-made wooden casket with a peaked roof, was placed. Inside were the bones of Jacobs, or whomever. The minister reminded us of Christ's words to his disciples, "Let not your hearts be troubled," and expressed the wish that George, if this be he, might also share in the promise of Christ, whatever that may be. An untroubled heart, I guess, or maybe eternal salvation. Later on, with me as one of the four pallbearers, the casket was carried across a field to the Rebecca Nurse burial plot and lowered into the ground on ropes. This was the first and only time I have helped bury somebody without knowing certainly who it was. Still later, another custom-made object, a stone grave marker for Jacobs carved in the Puritan style with a winged death head, would be installed on the spot for posterity. Why would someone with a disability be accused of malefic powers? Why credit somebody in a weakened condition with having supernatural strength? Witnesses against old Jacobs at his trial accused him of cruel and unusual brutality, saying he beat them with his walking sticks. But it was his specter, not his real-world self, that did the alleged battering. His servant, Sarah Churchwell, who came to Jacobs as a refugee from Indian attacks in Maine, said he made her life a waking nightmare. It was not hard for her to get people to believe her. To the New England settlers, the archfiend himself appeared as one disabled. In what could have been a remote reverberation of the old Greek myth about the land god Hephaestus, the white European devil had a cloven or club foot and carried a walking stick. At one of the executions, a local visionary said she saw Jacob's apparition being propped up by the devil himself. Certainly a classy form of elderly support. The historical George Jacob Sr. is known to have gotten around on a pair of crutches. They are mentioned in the court records, and one of them is in a Salem museum. And according to Richard Trask, in the alleged physical remains were found traces of osteoarthritis. Old George Jacobs doesn't loom large in the usual histories of the Salem witch trials, but locally he was a force to be reckoned with, both in his lifetime and later. In 1855, a painting called The Trial of George Jacobs for Witchcraft was produced and exhibited by New York artist T.H. Matson. Today it is in the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, along with a more titillating canvas by Matson called The Examination of a Witch, featuring a topless woman surrounded by leering Puritans. The Jacobs painting is not very exciting, but it is historically accurate, which is another way of saying that it is not very exciting. Old Jacobs also turns up in the film version of Arthur Miller's The Crucible as a cantankerous local eccentric who invites accusations from that nasty Putnam family by owning a 600-acre farm. It wasn't just people with physical oddities who were maligned as witches. People with mental difficulties were also targeted. Depressed women were especially vulnerable. More than one unhappy matron swore in court that the devil had seen her in her time of melancholy and offered her a comfort that was denied to her by her own relations and community. These days, if you are feeling bad, they give you pills and call you depressed. Back then, they put you in handcuffs and called you a witch. In 1676, the General Court of Massachusetts passed a law that affected distracted persons in some towns that are unruly, whereby not only the families wherein they are, but others suffer much damage by them. It is ordered that the selectmen in all towns where such persons are hereby empowered and enjoined to take care of all such persons that they do not damnify others. The courts took cognizance of numerous cases that revolved around distracted persons. In the 1680s, an Elizabeth Pike Carr, kin to the witch-accusing Ann Putnam Sr., petitioned the county court in Salem on behalf of her son John, who was crazed or distempered in his head for 7 years and is not capable to govern himself. Sometimes when people were constrained to take care of the mentally ill, there could be resentment and even fear. In Andover, a community noted for its political stability and intolerance to outsiders, one Thomas Parker, a mentally disturbed immigrant, alarmed and terrified his caretakers. Wrote one of these, "Parker was a lunatic man, one part off the moon. He was very much out of his senses, and sometimes outrageously mad or distracted, so as that he oftentimes endangered the great hurt or death of my wife and children, so that I did not dare to keep him any longer. When he was in his well frame, he would work well with guiding." Someone else reported that Parker often used to roam in the woods distracted and spoil his clothes. You didn't have to be smart to see his forest meanderings as leading to the devil and Indians, who by 1692 were laying waste to the frontier settlements. When he made his will, Parker's father described his son as being, by God's providence, disenabled for providing of himself or managing an estate if committed to him by reason of his distemper of mind at certain seasons. One complainant who approached the court about a troublesomely distracted relation was Nathaniel Soames of Gloucester. His sister Abigail was a bedridden eccentric with Quaker connections and a local reputation as a witch. As her caretaker, Nathaniel told the quarterly court at Salem Town, Abigail was in a distracted condition about this 2 months, and her brother Nathaniel had been forced to make it his whole employment to look after her. About 10 years after the petition, Abigail was back in Salem, not because her mental health was a problem, but because she was suspected of witchcraft. Her accuser was Mary Warren, famous as the finger-pointing servant in Miller's The Crucible. One person who was not impressed by Warren's gyrations in court was the prisoner, remarkably level-headed under the circumstances. "I have been distracted myself many a time," Soames reminisced, "and my senses have gone from me, and I have seen many a body hurt me, and might have accused many as she doth." In another time and setting, Warren and Soames might have settled their differences in a more amicable or less deadly way. Despite her ravings, Mary Warren had moments of lucidity that, if taken seriously, could have cast doubt on or derailed the prosecution. A few weeks before, she had distanced herself from the other witch accusers by calling them dissemblers, but her fate was like Cassandra's. Nobody believed her. In short order, Mary Warren was accused of witchcraft and thrown in jail. Nobody of any importance showed much interest in Mary Warren's mental state, healthy or otherwise. To the judges, she herself was not crazy. It was her trafficking with the devil that made her seem so. There was a pragmatic reason for their thinking this. If Warren were shown to be medically insane, it would reflect badly on the magistrates, who stood on the assumption that their witnesses, and by implication themselves, were sane. To malign Mary Warren's mental health would be to question the cognitive basis of the court proceedings. Most people were too scared to do that. Among other persons considered to be deranged or distracted in 1692 and called up at Salem for witchcraft was Rowley's John Jackson Sr., who was said to have a strange motion upon his spirit, that if he be persuaded to act at all, it is to overact or to overdo. I asked him the reason of it, why he should not act as other men do, for at that time he wrought so as if he would destroy himself. He told me he could not tell, but it came upon him about the time they took him from school. He had a great delight in leaving. A man after my own heart. At his examination for witchcraft in 1692, Jackson adjudged his afflicted accusers to be not in their right mind, an interpretation with which the judges did not agree. His son, John Jackson Jr., cried out much like a fool at his hearing when forced to touch his accusers. A bewitched matron in Salem Town lost her senses under the spells of Bridget Bishop and Alice Parker, or alleged that she did, but regained them after the women were hanged on Gallows Hill. Mood disorders, odd behavior, and suicide attempts could fuel witchcraft accusations. Giles Corey, famous for being pressed to death, but less well known for being a limping devil, the Jacksons, and others, were charged with making as if they would destroy themselves. If today we allow ourselves the mental luxury of dismissing the witchcraft accusations of our colonial ancestors as the pathological behavior of those people and that time, the historical architects of witch hunts took the question of sanity very seriously. Witchcraft experts like Cotton Mather regarded witchhood as requiring as much rational understanding and action as anything else. One didn't just become a witch. One decided to. At the Boston trial of an Irish Catholic washerwoman named Mary Glover in 1688, the judges appointed 5 or 6 physicians to examine her very strictly, whether she were not crazed in her intellectuals and had not procured to herself by folly and madness the reputation of a witch. The doctors returned her compos mentis, and sentence of death was passed upon her. Hmm. In early 1692, for whatever reasons, witchcraft accusations emerged in the family of Reverend Samuel Parris of Salem Village. Parris was a difficult, controversial figure who wrangled with his parishioners. His daughter and niece were suffering from inexplicable troubles, and doctors and ministers were nonplussed. Parris's slave or servant, an Indian woman named Tituba, became the first confessed witch to be rounded up, along with two disreputable village women. Tituba accused them and several others, accusations which set the stage for further prosecution. In late March, Salem villagers Martha Corey and Rebecca Nurse, both well-respected matrons and church members, were accused, examined, and sent to jail to await trial. At her hearing on 21 March, Corey stated that the afflicted accusers were not truly bewitched, but mentally unbalanced or distracted. For the first time in the 1692 record, a question arose of the mental competence of court witnesses in witchcraft cases. Corey's charge was audacious because the governing interpretation of witch accusers' courtroom behavior was not medical, but magical. When one of the children announced that she saw a demon whispering in Corey's ear, the matron responded, "We must not believe all these distracted children say." Later on, with the children rioting around her, screaming and writhing in their fits, Corey had the presence of mind to reiterate the point. But Judge John Hathorne, chief examiner and ancestor of novelist Nathaniel Hawthorne, took issue. "You charge these children with distraction. It is a note of distraction when persons vary in a minute, but these fix on you. This is not the manner of distraction." I'm going to go on for about another section because I think 20 minutes are about up. Okay. While Hathorne and the other judges refused to believe that accusers of witches were distracted, community gossip, that most unforgivably cruel of spectator sports, focused suspicion of witchcraft on people who did, in fact, have mental difficulties. One of them was a Salem Village woman named Rebecca Jacobs, the daughter-in-law of limping devil George Jacobs Sr., and the mother of teenage Margaret Jacobs, who were both accused. On 18 May, Rebecca made a public confession of witchcraft to the magistrates in Salem Village. Among other malefic deeds, she said she had murdered her 3-year-old daughter by dropping her down a well and drowning her. Rebecca's mother, in a later petition, reported that she is incapable of making that shift for herself that others can do. And this information could have given the accused woman some immunity to prosecution. Her trial was deferred. She was also not on record as accusing anybody else of witchcraft, which could indicate that the judges had some doubts about her credibility and competence, though they certainly didn't show any doubt about the other witnesses. The genealogist David L. Green points out that Rebecca Jacobs was a mentally ill woman who bore her husband several children during her disablement and carried on the normal duties of a good wife, and that this could say something about Puritan mores around married life. According to a contemporary account, Rebecca's children were so distraught when the constable picked her up that they ran a great way after the wagon crying. Apparently, their mother was so housebound that the accusers did not know her by sight. At her examination, only after some prompting, they cried out on her as Jacobs the old witch, despite her being only 46. She must have looked older. Possibly, Rebecca Jacobs was isolated socially. The subject of social isolation is absent from histories of New England Puritans. Certainly living with a husband with a history of angry outbursts that included horse drowning and long estranged from his irascible father can't have made Rebecca's integration with the community smooth or simple.
John,
so as far as I can go.
Can you read the end?
The very end?
Yeah.
Ah, well, this book is in two parts. The first part is my take on what happened. The second part is ruminations on the cultural stuff that came out of it, the plays, the movies, the films. There's an opera. Okay, here we go. Across town, adjacent to the old Puritan cemetery in Salem, where noteworthy witch hunters are buried, and the tasteful witch trial memorial, the Salem Wax Museum offers life-size dioramas of memorable moments in Salem's past, from witch trials on through the China trade, with a pirate or two thrown in for fun. The wax models were recycled from other such exhibitions and put in different clothes, so they represent people other than historical Salem dwellers. Giles Corey is portrayed by George Bernard Shaw, with full white beard and an evident case of dwarfism. In 1692, Essex County Sheriff George Corwin lined his pockets with the forfeited estates of the witches and wizards he had pushed off the gallows. His spirit shows no sign of having left Salem. Today, tourists get their pockets picked by snake oil salesmen masquerading as museum curators and custodians. The circumstances may be different, but the situation remains the same. That's how it is with myth. The end. Well, thanks for listening. I hope it doesn't give you nightmares.
I set out now in a box upon the sea.